Happy Thanksgiving. It seems like a wonderful holiday for me in the sense of a time to reflect on gratitude. Whether you do it alone or with other people or whatever way it's done, I think gratitude is one of the wonderful doors to a spiritual life or to a wise life. But I'm not going to talk about gratitude today. I'd rather talk about something very different. I'm going to talk about sloth. It's how people feel on Friday. Sloth and torpor. And the reason for this topic today is that I'm in the middle of doing a series here on Sundays on the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are those forces in the psyche which make it difficult for us to be present, that obscure the light of the mind, the luminosity of the mind. It's difficult for the mind to function in a natural or in a healthy way when the hindrances interfere with the healthy functioning of the mind. And these hindrances or these obscurations of the mind are five. At least the Buddha gives, actually there's seven, but they put it under five categories. And there's probably other things also, but these are considered very important for meditators, because as people get more and more still in meditation, these seem to have a strong hold that can kind of derail the meditation as we go along. But they're also very common in daily life, so it's always wonderful to talk about them because they seem relevant for everyone. So the first is clinging to sensual pleasure. The second is being caught up in ill will. The third, which is the topic for today, is sloth and torpor. The fourth is restlessness and anxiety. And the fifth is usually translated as doubt. We'll leave it there for now. So the mind can get caught in these forces and get lost in them. And get lost in desire, and you can hardly even know you're present. You hardly know what's going on. You hardly know what's going on subjectively or with ill will, but also with sloth and torpor. There's an ancient analogy that likens the mind to water. And that water can be polluted or be disturbed in various ways. And in this particular analogy, the hindrances are likened to mud. And when the mud is there, the clarity of the water is absent. So somehow the mud has to settle so we can see clearly into the water, into the pond. And in this particular analogy I'm thinking about, they have this idea in ancient India that there exists this magic stone that you can drop into the water and it'll somehow settle all the mud out. And in the mind, the magic stone is confidence. So if there's confidence is one of the great antidotes or one of the great settlers of the hindrances. When there's very strong confidence, some people would say faith, some people would maybe even say inspiration, but very strong confidence in what we're doing, in for example, in a spiritual life, the purpose of a spiritual life, confidence in ourselves, inspired by the possibilities of inherent in the spiritual life, then a person can be quite dynamic and active in engaging in spiritual practice. When the confidence is not strong, then it's very easy for these hindrances to take over. And, you know, it just seems like, well, it's not, you know, why would meditation be as important as, you know, going shopping or some other thing that people, you know, are caught up in, or planning revenge. Oh, that didn't hurt. mm-hmm. in that case, let me tell you that meditation is much better than planning revenge. So to have confidence. So confidence is the magic stone. But how do we get confidence? Confidence is, in the teachings of the Buddha, let me back up a little bit, sorry. I think sometimes a common association with Buddhist meditation and Buddhists is they're laid back. They're relaxed, you know, que sera sera, you know, everything's fine, we accept everything, nothing's going to bother us, you know, and everything's, you know, just hang out. And, you know, just calmly approach life, be very calm, relaxed. Calm, you know, meditation helps us to calm and be very relaxed, laid back. It's great. When you read the discourses of the Buddha, over and over and over again, you find that he emphasizes the importance of diligence, energy, ardency, engagement in some vigorous way with the spiritual life. Which sometimes is not the popular image of, you know, Buddhists. But, you know, this engagement, this active engagement with the spiritual life. Remember that the Buddha was a warrior. That's how he was raised. And so perhaps, you know, that's a little bit of that warrior spirit was there for his engagement in his practice life. How to be present, how to be here. The energetic way, the energized way of being present, of course, needs to be balanced with other factors. Calm is very important. Equanimity is very important. Tranquility is important. Other factors are important, but not at the expense of being energized. You know, sometimes the way to get, in some situations, the way to get relaxed, unstressed, is not to take a nap, is not to go just hang out and do nothing. Sometimes the best way to get relaxed is to go for a run or get some exercise, do something really vigorous, really engage yourself. And you come back from that and you feel, wow, I feel really relaxed, really at ease. Sometimes that's the wrong thing to do. Sometimes you need to take a nap. But energy is a really important quality of life. Energy is one of the things that helps bring balance into life in certain kinds of imbalances. Sloth and torpor as a hindrance are those forces in the mind that inhibit our wanting to make energy, to have energy available. Sometimes it's said sloth and torpor inhibits the questing movement of the life. That's not maybe a good word. I'm trying to avoid using the word striving, which is often the word that's used in the English translations. Striving, kind of questing, or certain kind of strong motivation for engaging in the practice. So sloth and torpor gets in the way, hinders the application of energy, applying ourselves. And now there's many kind of things that can hinder, that relate to sloth and torpor. Tiredness is one of them. Strictly speaking, tiredness is not sloth and torpor. It's said that an enlightened person can be tired, but an enlightened person would not have sloth and torpor in her mind. Sloth and torpor is a little bit of a psychological issue. Sometimes you can see it as a reaction to things, a complex or in the mind, rather than a physical kind of issue of if there's energy or not energy. And you see it a lot in kids. It's really dramatic in kids. I'm sure you see it in adults too. But my kid can swing from sloth and torpor to being energized in 2 seconds. And when he's bored or he doesn't like what's going on or something, it's just like, it's amazed how drained he is. And you just tell him, you know, we'd like ice cream. And boy, you know, he's like ready to go. Head for the door, shoes are on, and he's, you know, the energy is available there. Or perhaps some of you have had the experience of laying in bed in the morning, not wanting to get out of bed. It's kind of like, you know, it's cold winter time. And just so comfortable, and you don't have the energy for it, you know. It's kind of like so nice, and, you know, you don't feel inspiration, enthusiasm, the energy, the confidence, whatever. Just You just lay there. And then somehow you glance at your clock and you realize in 5 minutes you're going to be late for work. And it's a half an hour drive and you're not even dressed. And you're out of bed, you know, and suddenly there's all this energy. There you go. You're off and running. So I don't know if that's the best analogy, but the best story example, but certainly energy can be available very quickly if we understand the situation differently or something happens that arouses it. Energy is often available, but it's hindered or kept back or not tapped into or not utilized. So sloth and torpor is part of these forces of the psyche which inhibit the application of energy, being engaged and being involved. When sloth and torpor is really strong, we sink into it and get lost into it, and the mind can feel like mud. The mind can feel like glue, like you can hardly apply yourself. It's very difficult to make effort, even psychic effort, like pay attention. This becomes really strong on people on retreats. Meditation retreats is a kind of way of, there's a way sometimes where things get exaggerated on retreats in ways we don't really experience in daily life. And sometimes on retreats, the mind can feel so dull and so heavy and so lethargic, so like nothing's possible. You can't. It's like lifting 200-pound weights just trying to get the mind to pay attention to the breath. Or sometimes the mind just keeps shutting down. You get lost in thoughts and fantasies and just doesn't want to make any effort to do anything except be lost in its own slothful fantasies. Sometimes you see meditators, probably some of you have seen me do this, sitting up here, kind of nodding off. You know. And it's not always a symptom of sloth and torpor, but it certainly can be. And, falling asleep, just so hard to wake up and pay attention. So it's interesting to understand some of the causes, or some of the reasons why sloth and torpor might be present. I mean, certainly tiredness can contribute to it. And we have a culture which is sleep deprived, it's been said. And I think a lot of people need sleep more than they need meditation. And then you read these great stories of the great yogis who manage on 2 hours of sleep a night. And I'm getting 6 hours. I'm sure I can cut it down to five and add meditation to my life. You know, and sometimes adding meditation to your life is just not, you know, if it means getting up earlier and just being even more sleep deprived, is not the right thing. There's tremendous weariness in the body, in the muscles, that sets in because some people are chronically aroused, chronically tense or anxious, chronically excited, sometimes in a very good way, but sometimes it's a kind of chronic excitement in the muscles and the tightness and the holding. The different muscles are kind of opposing each other, the flexors and the extenders over there. After a few months and a few years of that kind of excitement in the system, arousal in the system, the muscles just get worn out. It's possible to just sit completely still and get exhausted when the muscles are kind of tense all the time. So sometimes there's physical tension that sets in that makes it very difficult for there to be energy available. We're just deeply, deeply weary and tired. Some people are surprised to go on retreats and to realize how deeply, deeply weary they are. It seems like we're tired down into their bones. And sometimes it comes from the way people have lived their lives. And unless we change how we live our lives, that exhaustion will go deep, deep down. And I think sometimes there's physical illnesses that set in because of that chronic exhaustion, the chronic tension that people live under. Sometimes sloth and torpor sets in because it involves some kind of resistance to something. We really don't want to pay attention. We really don't want to be here. We don't want to experience what's going on. And it can take the form of boredom. It can take the form of lethargy. It can take the form of dullness. Many different forms of just kind of like, I don't want to pay attention. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be with this experience. And sometimes it sets in as the downside of no longer being aroused by desire or anger or fear or various ways in which people keep themselves aroused. If the normal arousal systems are not present, then some people feel kind of dullness and the flatness. Maybe it's a little bit uncomfortable, and people would rather not be there flat. They're used to being pumped up. And if you're not pumped up, it's not so comfortable, and you just fall asleep. For some people, sloth and torpor is a transition that they have to go through. If you're always aroused in some unhealthy way, then stopping that arousal, maybe sloth and torpor will replace it, and it's a transition. You have to kind of allow yourself to go through that transition as you kind of unwind. It's kind of like caffeine withdrawal. You kind of let a few days go, just kind of let it go through it. But sometimes the resistance is something really deep. You know, you see babies falling asleep when they're overstimulated. Baby's been having all the nap baby needed, and you put it into a big, noisy environment, and the baby falls asleep. It's got a protective mechanism that seemingly babies have. The only place I see that in adults operating is sometimes, that I know, most obviously, is in meditation, where sometimes people start falling asleep in meditation, or a really strong sloth and torpor sets in, because some deep memory, some deep feeling that they don't want to look at or deal with is coming up. Not that. And so it's kind of a protective mechanism for adults, falling asleep, not paying attention. Sometimes sloth and torpor sets in because there's discouragement. And we've been trying and trying for a while, just so discouraging. And we're focusing on the failure, we're focusing on, unhealthy, unuseful thoughts. One of the important lessons I had in the monastery around thoughts was there was a period of time that I was really sick. And it was a time when everybody was sitting retreat, but I was working in the kitchen. And somehow I decided to keep working in the kitchen. Maybe it was a bad idea, not think about it. But anyway, you forgive me for that. But I felt like I had to keep working, but I was really sick. And because I was so sick, I had to be very attentive to my thoughts. Because I could see that if I thought certain thoughts, I would get drained. My energy level would drop. If I thought other thoughts, my energy level would go up a little bit. And in order to maintain myself in that sick state, I had to track my thoughts so that I wouldn't drain myself, so I could stay there in a productive way working in the kitchen. And I was so sensitive because the consequences were so big. I was so sick. Most people are not living so sensitive to the subtle influence or effect that their thinking has. But thoughts of discouragement, thoughts of failure, thoughts of it's too much, thoughts of all kinds of thoughts we have, they just kind of drain our energy, drain our enthusiasm, and drain our confidence. So we don't want to make the effort. Not now. I'll give up. Sloth and torpor can set in out of complacency. And this was a big hindrance for me during my period of Zen practice especially, where I attained a certain degree of comfort in my meditation practice. It was very comfortable. Just being present was nice. And in that comfort, a warm, kind of fuzzy, warm, comfortable feeling, I kind of was lulled into not making any more effort. And that's where I spent a lot of time in Zen practice, falling asleep. Because it was just, it was just nice. It was comfortable. It was like nothing to attain. There was no goal, I was told. It was great. And so complacency can be a cause for sloth and torpor. Laziness can be similar. It's too lazy, we don't want to make the effort. I found that effort often begets effort. There's a wonderful way that we apply ourselves, that there might be resistance initially, but that after a while, if we keep making the effort and doing it, something sets in that is not our will, not our efforting anymore. It's kind of like if I go for a run, if I haven't run for a long time, there's resistance the first 100 yards, or the first longer. And at some point, something else sets in and becomes easier. The resistance is not there. Same thing in a spiritual life, in meditation. There can be resistance, there can be hesitation, it can be manual effort sometimes to overcome the inertia that exists in the mind. But at some point, if you keep making the effort, something else kicks in and a healthy kind of effort arises. And if you give up when there's a lot of resistance, when it's manual labor in meditation, then you're not going to come to the next level. And even for me, someone who's not meditated for a long, long time, there are still times where meditation is like manual labor, hard work. And when that's the case, I have enough wisdom to know that I just have to keep applying myself, doing that hard work. So sometimes when I sit, especially on a retreat, I feel it, you know, in my body, that my body is doesn't seem to have, not only is there no mental effort, but there's no physical energy. Somehow that I can't even hold my body upright very easily. I mean, right now I can hold my body up pretty easily, but there are times when my body just wants to collapse and there's no energy to hold it up. And what I've learned is I have to just keep coming up to a good posture and making the effort to have a good, straight, upright posture, not give in to that tiring or draining energy. And just keep making the effort. And at some point, something gets aroused inside of me. And it's kind of like magic or mystery. I don't know what it is, but sometimes something takes over and the energy kind of arises from the inside and there I am. And then it's easy to stay upright. Sometimes it's hard to believe I'll ever be able to have energy again. And then But again, confidence is really important. To have confidence in the practice, confidence in the value of making effort, of applying oneself, is really, really important. When sloth and torpor, you just have to keep trying, keep applying yourself. Energize yourself somehow. There's a lot of ways of energizing oneself in this sloth and torpor. In meditation itself, sitting in meditation, it can be physical, you know, just sitting up straighter and having more physical presence. And it can be mental, where we kind of apply ourselves more to noticing, to being present. Being more fully engaged with the breath, being more fully attentive to what's happening in the present moment. So the analogy that I've read recently is two people come to a big feast. And one person's approach to the feast is just kind of flit along all the different dishes and kind of look, that's great, and never taste anything. Another person's approach is to see the first dish and gorge. And one person's stay is always aroused, excited and nervous or whatever, and the second person is just gets so lethargic very quickly because of overeating. A third person comes along and just very calmly comes over and takes one full bite from the first dish, really tastes it and savors it, gets to know it really well, goes to the next dish and really gets to know that really well, and at some point stops. Mindfulness, you know, there's different approaches to how to be mindful. And some people are too casual and quick. Some people kind of linger too much and kind of get weighed down by their experience. But there's an art to learning how to have just the right engagement with what we're paying attention to, the breath, the feelings, the body sensations, the sounds, whatever it might be. So to somehow adjust the energy level, the effort we have in how we know something. Knowing is not... There's a range of energy that's available for how we know something, know it really well. That's another way of having more energy. Another fascinating way of working with sloth and torpor is to make sloth and torpor the object of your attention. So rather than resisting it and pushing it away and trying to overcome it by focusing on something else, it's to go and turn the attention and feel what it's like to be slothful, torporful. You know, and feel the heaviness, feel the dullness, feel all the different, you know, in the cheeks and the shoulders and the eyes and inside the brain. And, you know, feel what we actually feel like, feel where it actually is. And sometimes a careful investigation of it can somehow turn it around and kind of arouse the energy and the effort. Sometimes thinking differently can help with sloth and torpor. So watching how we're thinking and adjusting it, changing it. And it said that certain kinds of thoughts tend to arouse more energy and are good antidotes to a mind that's filled with sloth and torpor. So one of the classic things to think about if you're really in the grips of sloth and torpor and you can't make any energy and can't arouse yourself is think about death. And now some people, I know death is, you know, puts them to sleep or just not the right thing. But if you're one of those people for whom thinking about your death arouses you, gives, you know, maybe you should do it. You know, just, oh, whoa. You do not know when death will visit you. Oh, it could be, you know, now. It could be today. It could be tomorrow, next week. Who knows? And that's a classic reflection in Buddhism, is to reflect on death and the uncertainty of when death will come as a way of arousing healthy energy and motivation to engage in spiritual practice. If reflecting on death makes you depressed, then it's not the right practice for you. But if it arouses you, that's one way. Jack Kornfield tells a story of having sloth and torpor on retreat. And his teacher had him go sit at the edge of, on the edge of a well. So, you know, if you have this problem, you sit, imagine sitting, you're sitting really, really tired and slothful. And, and then you're awake for a while. I don't know if, you know, I don't know if I recommend that. I know one person I knew had a problem with falling asleep. And in the, so he went and got some kind of bowl that's kind of fit on top of his head, and it would, you know, kind of maybe a soft one or cloth one or something that fit, you know, well up here. And then he put all these marbles inside of it. And then so that if he fell asleep in the meditation hall, everyone would know the bowl would fall over and marbles would be all over the floor. And I don't know what the conclusion of that story was, but. Oh, here's a story that I like telling. Because it's kind of, it's so when I was at Tassajara, and they had this big bell in the meditation hall, and it's someone's job every meditation session to sit in front of that big bell. There's a small bell next to it also, and but you sit in front of the big bell, and then at the end of the meditation session, you ring the small bell to signal the end of the sitting. So that was my job for a while. So I'm sitting there meditating. And there's this big bell right in front of me. And if you fall asleep, bong, my forehead, you know, went up against this bell. And everybody knew Gil had fallen asleep. Because that was not the bell that's supposed to ring right now. It's the small bell, not the big bell. And I was a little bit proud of it. Not for that, but I was a little bit proud. Maybe it's kind of vanity, or maybe it's, yeah, I shouldn't admit my foibles here, but because in that one meditation session, I did it again. And what I was kind of happy with it was, I was kind of relaxed. The fact that I just blown it in the monastery and everybody knew I'd blown it hadn't gotten me so self-conscious that I was, you know, so aroused I wouldn't do it again. I know, we grab for small things. So sloth and torpor. And then there's practical things to do. Some people like to do walking meditation. If sloth and torpor is really a big issue, it's hard to have a lot of sloth when you're walking. So you walk vigorously. Have the physical energy to help carry you and get you going. My teacher in Burma, he power walked when he did walking meditation. You know, literally. And he had this room specially built next to his little house. It was kind of like a little, you know, and it was a room built for walking meditation. And it was about this wide. It's like a hallway, but it didn't go anywhere. You know, it just went along the side of the house, and he would go back and forth. Sometimes doing things like washing the hands and the face and the neck and the feet with cold water can help. You come do that before you sit, and sometimes it helps, gets things going. Sometimes for us, meditating with the eyes open, because usually we meditate with the eyes closed, can help. Some people seemingly get help from sitting in front of strong light sources. So go sit in front of a bright window or have a light, have it on. Even with the eyes closed, the light comes in and can keep kind of things more clarity there, more alertness. I've heard of the advice, I've never done it, of visualizing or imagining white light, like filling the mind with white light when you sit, is a way of overcoming sloth and torpor. But remember that the magic stone for the hindrances is confidence. So perhaps when sloth and torpor is most strong, that what needs to be done is a reflection on what brings you confidence, where you have confidence, or your lack of confidence. And what can you have confidence in? And some people, for example, you know, a lot of people, I think, are spiritually starved. And so sometimes it's really helpful to feed a little bit. You come to this, you know, sometimes in the Bay Area we have a spiritual feast. So you don't want to gorge. But you don't want to kind of be too, you know, flighty either. But you really want to engage and take it in. And sometimes sloth and torpor is really supported by arousing our inspiration, our spiritual inspiration, our faith, our confidence. And that's part of the value of sitting with other people, to be inspired by the possibility of practice. So that's about all I could think about saying about sloth and torpor for today. What do you think? Do you have any questions or comments, or do you want to do testimonials around sloth and torpor in a way that's helpful? Yes?
Wait, just a second.
Oh, yes, it would be good if
you use this, so.
Pass it on. We'll get another mic someday so we don't have to pass it so far.
But actually, it's almost here.
It's almost here.
In the two stories you told, in the two stories you told about falling into the well and humiliating yourself with hitting the bell, it seems those are both about fear. Do you have any ways to arouse yourself in the areas of, say, desire?
Or using desire as an arousal mechanism?
Well, you're clearly touching into to these aversive feelings in the others. Do you have any in the other direction?
Well, I think that being inspired by a spiritual possibility spiritual desire can be very healthy. And so you see, oh, it's really possible. I'm inspired. You see someone and you meditate with someone. Like when I was the story comes to mind is when I was in Burma, seeing the 500 women meditators meditating with such dignity and stillness was so inspiring for me. I said, yeah, I can do that too. I can sit that way. It's like, I can do that. And so that kind of feeling of I can do it and I want to do it can be very healthy in a spiritual life. And that can certainly overcome sloth and torpor. So spiritual desire. I mean, it's possible to get aroused by other kinds of desire. And I don't know, you know, it's like I've never done that intentionally as a technique to overcome sloth and torpor, but maybe you can have some wonderful sexual fantasy and you set a timer. I'm only going to do this for 3 minutes. And when I get the charge, I'm going to let go of it and just sit and meditate. You know, does that work? Maybe then you have to work with another desire. You have energy, but you have another hindrance to deal with. But it's a good question. But why don't you answer the question? Do you have any experience with using desire?
I was really asking it from the standpoint that I've been very much lately thinking about the teaching on how each of the things that we do reconditions the rebirth of that same thing again.
Yes.
And so to the extent that we use these devices, we should be wise in choosing.
Right.
So that we don't habituate our minds in those directions that are not so wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's good. Now, the reflection on death, certainly can arouse fear in an unhealthy way, unuseful way. But reflection on death can also be very arousing in a healthy way. And it often is for people. I mean, some people in life encounter sickness, old age, and death in some very dramatic way. And it really gives them a really, I would say, kind of healthy energy. Oh, this is really important. I have to apply myself. I'm not going to waste time. And for some people, maybe it's not healthy. In the Zen monasteries, they use traditionally, they use what's called the stick. It's called a kiyosako. And it was called a monitor, will walk around the hall carrying the stick. And it's like a long sword. And if you're falling asleep, whack. And just knowing that person's coming around. You know, stay awake. And in most Zen centers that I know in America have stopped using the stick. But in Japan, when I was there, and they certainly used it there, in Japan, you would just be given it, you know, whatever it hit you. But in America, they also had the option of asking for it, and I often asked for it, and I found it very useful and helpful to be. It's kind of like almost like, you know, some kind of point. You get struck between the shoulder blade and the spine, and. And if it's done well, it has a zing to it, but it doesn't really hurt. And it's actually quite energizing, and it feels really wonderful. So it's this person be walking around, and I wasn't afraid of the person particularly, but somehow there was this feeling of being accountable. This person was watching in there, and I felt like I just wanted to. It felt healthy to me. I said, okay, I'll be more attentive here, be present more. And wake up. And when the monitor wasn't there, it wasn't quite as, you know, I wouldn't apply myself as much. So we're not going to adopt that here. Yes?
The kiyosaku stick was also good if you were stuck in any state, if you were restless.
Yeah.
I found, and I asked for it, and it would change that. I know at the Zen Center of Los Angeles, the monitors would make sure you were awake. If they saw you falling asleep, they'd scream, tell you to wake up. That usually did the trick.
I've often used the pulling of the ear, and I often wonder if that's how the Buddha got his long ears.
Pinching your ears or pulling the ears to get energy.
I found for myself to wake up at the same time every morning reduces sloth and torpor a lot for myself, to have a regular pattern where I become awake. And then the other thing I've noticed about myself is that if I'm in meetings that I'm really not, it could be a seminar, it could be anything, I'll nod off. And I think that's psychological. I don't think it's because if I'm in another meeting where I'm energized or something, I have no problem with it. But sometimes it's just, I'm not there for it.
Some people are aroused when they're getting praised, and some people are aroused, energized when they're being criticized. But when what's happening and what's being said has no bearing at all on their ego, they'll get bored and fall asleep. Some people, you know, their energy depends on how much their ego is being attacked or supported. And if thing has nothing, no relationship to their ego or their sense of self. And sometimes it's quite ugly, that phenomenon. Some people will turn away, not pay attention to people for whom there's no benefit for their ego. But for people who, you know, there's egotistical benefit or egotistical danger, they're aroused around those people. Yes?
I'm wondering if you can comment on torpor and being frozen.
Being frozen?
Yeah, because if there's fear that can arouse torpor, then there's, and confidence is the antidote, then when there's the sensation of actually being frozen, does that fit into torpor, or, you know, how do you see that?
I don't know. What comes to mind is that fear is usually categorized as a form of aversion, and if fear is really strong, it could be certainly have frozen quality to it. And fear can certainly. But you know, being frozen seems to me to be a very energized state. Even though you know, it's like everything's all the energy is flowing into just being locked up. But it isn't like you're relaxed. It's a high energized state. So I don't know if that qualifies as sloth and torpor. But I don't know.
I don't either. I just see that. Can both stop the process.
Yes. All five of the hindrances can stop the process, can stop our presence. And yes, Kumi, and then the last one.
Thank you. I wonder if going with intention, clear intention about maybe with clarity or being awake or building confidence or going with clear intention every time, do you think that would be good?
Oh, yeah. I think if there's clarity about what we're doing.
Is that just understood?
No, I think that's good. I think if there's clarity about what we're doing, it's easier to make the effort. And sometimes sloth and torpor or laziness or lack of application arises because people aren't sure what they're doing. What they're doing, how they're doing, what the purposes of what they're doing. And so sometimes a greater clarity of purpose needs to be aroused or understood. And so in a spiritual life, like on retreat, for example, maybe you need to go to a teacher and talk about it. You know, what am I really doing here? Why am I here? And get that really clear. Some people just have a general vague idea that's good for them to meditate. You know, then they're not going to really apply themselves so well. So to have real clarity of purpose is really helpful. The other thing that's I'll end with is that one of the little secrets or treasures of a meditative life is that, and this applies particularly on retreats, but also in daily life, is that the practice unfolds best through the continuity of our best effort. And the quality of effort goes up and down over the day, and over the weeks and months, whatever. Everything's impermanent. Everything rises and passes. Our effort and our energy level goes up and down also. And so we have to be gracious with the ups and downs as they go through our days and months. But regardless of how much effort and energy is available, if we give it the best energy that's available, that's what bears fruit over time. So there are times when you're tired, energy is not going to look so good. But it's the best you know, it's the best you have available. When you're really rested and energized, it's really dynamite your effort, and that's the best effort. I suffered a lot on my retreats, by being self-critical about the degree of my effort at times when I was tired, thinking that it was a personal failing that I was tired and I didn't have the good effort there. And eventually what I learned was that it didn't really matter whether I was tired or not. In the long term, what mattered was I just gave it the best effort that I had. So I wouldn't give up when I was tired, and I wouldn't berate myself when I was tired. I would just do the best I could, given what I had available. So the continuity of our best effort bears fruit over time. So, in other words, when sloth and torpor visits you, don't give up. Just keep practicing. Do the best you can. So thank you.